Om Shanti 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 Om. Peace. Good afternoon. It's good to be with you again. It's good seeing you, being with you, listening to you, listening to all your problems. Before we get into the questions, I'll make some opening remarks. There's only one way to become liberated. And that is to awaken. Just to awaken. Just wake up. Just as you do in the morning when you wake up from sleep. You were in a dream world and you woke up. In the same way, you awaken to yourself. The way to do this is to be at satsang. To surrender. To the self. When you surrender to the self, you're surrendering to life. You're no longer thinking, this has to work out this way, this has to work out that way, this has to be improved, I've got to read this book, I've got to go see this teacher. True surrender is allowing your heart, your spiritual heart, to take over, and you have nothing to do and nothing to say. All of the practices are incidental. Sadhana is important to make you come to the realization that you have to wake up. That's all sadhana is for. It's for no other reason. Sadhana, spiritual practices, do not wake you up by themselves. They have no awakening powers. But they put your mind to rest. When your mind is at rest, you awaken. Why do you want to be liberated? Of course, you are already liberated. That's your real nature. The one who wishes to become liberated, to awaken, looks at this world. They've been through many vicissitudes. They've been through many problems, through many rituals. They've had good times and bad times. And they have come to the conclusion that there is something else more beautiful and grand than they can ever imagine. In other words, they realize that the finite mind can never, never bring them to that place. There is nothing in this world, or in any other world, or in any other state, that can bring them eternal happiness and eternal joy, bliss consciousness. The only way to get there is to awaken. they become interested in awakening. When you become interested in awakening, you do not run around adding things to yourself. It is ludicrous to me to see people adding more book knowledge, learning things like the Kabbalah, the ancient scriptures, the Vedas. Every time a new book comes out, they read it, searching for different teachers, looking for the answers outside themselves. There is no thing outside yourself that can give this to you. Therefore, these people have wisdom. They've got jnana. And they begin to see that awakening is the only way to get there. The world has fooled them long enough. They therefore begin to let go, not to add. If they love a tree and they love roses, they begin to see that's an attachment. That's holding them back from total realization, from awakening. The tree and the rose are an emanation of your mind. You have created it. The source is yourself. This is a new revelation to most people. The beauty out there does not come by itself and you behold it. That's the way it appears. But in truth and in reality, the beauty you behold is your own beauty, your own joy, your own love. You are that. And the manifestation is the tree or the rose or the mountain or the ocean, the sky. What if you were able to pull those feelings that you have towards these things deep within yourself and become them? You will then discover the truth that you have always been that. There is nothing outside that is not within you. This is something that should be remembered all of the time. You should always be aware of this. There is nothing out there that is not within here. If you understand this totally, where do you have to go? Whom do you have to see? What do you have to read? What is there to do? You can simply sit and be the universe and bask in glory. And total love, total joy. Think of all the things you're doing to try to get enlightened. The worst thing you can do is speak too many words. Words lead to other words. And they lead to other words. And you become a talking encyclopedia. The process is simply to let go. To get rid of the talking, talking, talking. To get rid of the wanting, the desires, to believe that something is out there that can do something to you. This is why satsang is so important. When you come here, you put your mind to rest for a while. As you begin to feel the power of satsang, your mind becomes pulled. The mind is pulled in to the spiritual heart center. Deeper and deeper it goes. As you empty yourself, as you no longer desire anything, you begin to live spontaneously. You live in the moment. That moment is filled with bliss, filled with absolute reality. There's nothing to say. There's nothing to do. And yet you will find the body doing whatever it came to this earth to do. It's a beautiful way to live. You are not a doer. You're not doing a thing mentally. Your mind is quiescent, calm, like a motionless lake. And yet your body is doing whatever it's supposed to do. If you're supposed to be a bank manager, you become one. But yet your mind is not active. If you're supposed to be a garbage collector, you become that. There's no difference. It's all the same. Your mind is not working, but the self is. And just like the tree, it does not think, will I grow new leaves next year? Or if it's an apple tree, will I bloom apples? Will I grow apples next year, or will I die? The wind is strong. Looks like a hurricane coming. I better prepare myself. The apple tree does not think like this. It cannot. By its very nature, it produces apples every year. Your nature is to be in glory and bliss. Your nature is to be totally enlightened. Your nature is consciousness. Your nature is to cause the I of yourself to disappear. To annihilate the mind and the ego and become totally free and liberated. Remember the important points. You have to let go, not add on. It is true when you find a new environment, when you see a new teacher, when you read a new book, the novelty is very strong, it's great. Because everything is new, and human beings love change. Change is the ego. It is the ego that pushes you around the world. I want you to do this and do that and see this and change jobs and go change teachers and change clothes and change. The ego does all these things for you. When you remember this, you will remember who your master is. The more active you become mentally, the greater the ego, the greater the mind. And the mind is your master, the mind is your God. For you're following your mind. If you learn to control your mind, you will have less desires, less needs and less wants, and you will find eternal bliss, eternal peace, eternal happiness. No one can really interfere in your life. It is your life. You came to this earth specifically to transcend the body and become eternally free. Consequently, see what you're doing with your life, how you act every day, the things that disturb you, the things that annoy you, the things that frighten you, the things that you love, the things that you want, the things that you enjoy. They're all imposters. They're all lies. The truth is that you are eternal Satchitananda, Para Brahman, absolute reality, pure intelligence, ultimate oneness, nirvana, emptiness. You are that. Stay like that. And be happy. Amelia, will you pass me the question box? Okay, we're starting a new thing today. Rather than I continue talking, you all have some question and you have something that's on your mind that you don't like to speak of in public. So when you write it out, you do not have to sign it. Therefore, you can say anything you like. You can call me names and do whatever you want. So that's question number one. It's time. I have started to pray, and it flows as if I am trying to walk with two left feet. One of them turned backward. How can I increase devotion, fervor? Anonymous Fred.
You were supposed to read the last one.
If it's on here, I read it. So the question is, you can make a book out of the question.
That's number one.
The question is, how do I really pray and increase devotion? Do not believe that you have to do this yourself. feel as if there is somebody within you that knows how to pray. There's a power and a presence that already knows how to pray and is already devoted. You start by thinking of a few words. You realize that what you call God is universal, and as long as you believe you are an ego or separate or the body, then you are finite. Therefore, the finite prays to the universal. What you do is simply say, "Not my will, but thine." You can always start a prayer like that. You're saying, "I don't need anything myself, but whatever you know is right for me, I surrender myself to you." There is a being that appears to be apart from you, and you call that being God, infinite. God knows what is right for you and what is good for you, and what your needs are. True prayer is again surrendering to this God. As you keep surrendering every day by saying, "Not my will, but thine," that's very powerful. You develop humility, you develop humbleness, you become very humble. You're no longer proud and cynical and arrogant as you keep saying, "Not my will, but thine." And pretty soon after you do this, a couple of months or so, something happens to you. You begin to feel that this deity that you've been praying to, giving yourself up, is none other than yourself. You've been praying to yourself, but not the self which is Fred, but the self which is God as you. And then you begin to sit in the silence, recognizing that you are not the body or the doer, but that you are greater than this. And even if you do not know yet what it is or feel it, you do begin to feel peaceful. As you continue this for a while, you find that Fred begins to disappear, or Fred gets smaller and smaller, and the deity you've been praying to, which is yourself, becomes greater and greater. When this happens to you, all words stop. You become aware. Your prayer consists of sitting in the silence. There are no needs, there are no desires. You merely spend time sitting in the silence, contemplating the self, which is you. You are no longer human at this point. there is no longer a human being. Your prayer has led you towards liberation. So praying is very important, but not to pray for things. But to know God's will. Thy will be done. That's the extent of your prayer. And God's will is always good will. You get a job at Goodwill. You drive the truck. It all turns out beautiful. When you're working for Goodwill, whatever you do. But you have learned that you are not yourself with a small s as a human being. And prayer has led you to oneness. Therefore, the right kind of prayer is thy will be done. That's it. This makes you devotional. This makes you go higher in consciousness and ultimately sets you free.
Excuse me, I have a question on that, because I thought right away of the words thy will be done, and as soon as I say it, I feel a hypocrite. Because it's I am telling God, your will is done, your will be done.
You're not really doing that. When you say, thy will be done, you're not telling God his will is going to be done your way. What you're really doing is surrendering yourself to God. Thy will, not my will. Question number two. When will we again meet 3 hours every satsang? 2 to 3 long sessions of silence. Everything we do is spontaneous.
Okay.
Somebody wants to spend 3 hours at satsang with 2 or 3 long sessions of silence. We usually do this on Thursdays and some of it on Sundays. I really have no idea how long we take. But we will start having maybe special meetings on Saturdays where we can spend 2 or 3 hours just in silence and do nothing. Everything I do is spontaneous. And something that does what I do observes the students and does what is necessary for the people who come here. Consequently, sometimes we sit for longer periods in silence. Sometimes we sit for shorter periods. But the truth of the matter is that everything that takes place in satsang is the silence. Everything is silence. What are you seeing? You want certain formal ways of doing things. You want 2 hours of silence, 25 minutes of talking, a half hour of asking questions. When you come to satsang, do not think how things should be or how they want to be or how you think they should be. Rather, put yourself into satsang and let your mind be silent and not think of anything at all. and let everything take care of itself, then you will grow and you will see results. In other words, what I'm saying, don't be the type of person who comes to satsang and starts thinking, I hope we have 2 hours of silence and 20 minutes of talking. Do not think of anything at all. But just get involved in the satsang. Try to be open and empty. And let your heart listen to what's going on. Everything will take care of itself. Question number 3. When will we incorporate Ramana Maharshi's name in our chants before Sunday satsang? Oh, I see what you mean. When we sing the song Kindle My Light, we use Muktananda's name because that's the song. We can't change that because that's the Muktananda song and it's a beautiful song. But it would be a good idea if we can sing a song that has Ramana's name in it.
Why can't you change it and substitute Ramana? There's no copyright on it.
I don't know if it's legal or not.
I checked with Indira. She knows the person who wrote the song, and she said there would be no objection.
Okay, so let's change the name.
Yeah. Get our boy in there.
Are you think he's not?
I want to hear it.
Good, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Question number 4. Will you please speak on the subject of the grace of the Guru? How does a student come under the influence of grace? That's a good question. By surrender and by devotion. Grace flows by itself when there's absolutely nothing in your mind holding you back. When you come here and you give yourself away, you're totally devoted. You're of total service. You totally surrender. Then, only then, do you pick up the grace that is already flowing. There never was a time when the grace was not flowing. Grace is always here. But you have to make yourself available to it. And you do so by surrendering yourself to the self, to the guru, to the consciousness. When you do this, you're not surrendering yourself to Robert. Robert does not exist. You're surrendering yourself to omnipresence, to omniscience, which is all pervading. This is hard for a person with a big ego. It's sort of hard for most Westerners. But that's exactly what you have to do. You have to have trust and faith. And those are the people who make the most progress. But when you come here and you think that you are yourself as a human being, and I am another human being that you came to see, you stop the grace from flowing because you're involved in materialism. You're thinking of two separate human beings. But when you come to see me and you realize that I'm none other than yourself, there's only one self, and that self is I am. And that self is all pervading. Then that's a whole new ball game. And then grace automatically flows. You pick it up. You become it. Grace is another name for the self. It all has to do with your attitude. This is why I talk so much about seeing so many teachers, because all these different teachers have a name. And you're building up your ego when you go and say, I am going to see this teacher by name, I am going to see that teacher tomorrow by name, I'm going to go to this teacher by name. You forget that there is only consciousness. And the teacher has no name. But you get lost in the shuffle when you read so many books by so many authors and you see so many teachers with so many names. Find the teacher that appeals to you most. Stay with that one. Surrender to that one, give yourself to that one. Become that one. And you'll see yourself what happens. But again, I admit this is most difficult with most Westerners. They're not used to something like this. They're mainly used to going through lectures, to churches, to see what this person has to say and what that person has to say. If somebody will speak the magic word and he will become enlightened, which is very funny. The true devotee forgets about enlightenment. They simply keep surrendering and letting go. And then grace becomes evident. Next case. It looks like the same person is on all these questions. Can the guru discern the state of awareness of the student? Can he tell how close to full realization the student is? Can he discern the blocks to realization? The answer is yes. This is the reason why many times you tell me that you are predicament became much worse since you've met me sometimes. This is why all of a sudden certain changes come into your life. Things are moving. All the karma you've had inside of you for many centuries is coming to the surface and being completely wiped out. You therefore experience newness. The newness may be not to your liking in the beginning, but the more faith and the more trust you have in the self, the faster you snap out of it and become totally free. I'm more aware of you than you can ever imagine. I watch. I do not say much. I allow the unfoldment to come by itself. But what do you do? How do you think? What is your reaction? That's important. Does the guru have personal knowledge of the efforts of grace on his students? Is grace an impersonal force, or financial or spiritual? Do physical healings come as a result of grace? Grace itself is Brahman. It has nothing to do with physical, financial, or anything else. Everything unfolds in your life the way it's supposed to when you surrender, when you let go. Yes, the guru does have personal knowledge of what's going on in your life. But the guru keeps silent most of the time and observes and watches. What the understanding is that most of the people are not ready to be told anything else at this time, for it will have an adverse effect. So the self watches and waits. Watches and waits. As you go through many trials and tribulations, so-called, and experiences in life, the guru waits and sees whether you're going to survive and still come back, or whether you will become angry and go somewhere else. The yoni is aware of these things, but just watches and waits. A good example is the class today. We usually have half of the students, or we have half the students that we usually have. And that's great as far as I'm concerned, that's why I like it. But the people who are here have come to listen to this particular message. This message that is being spoken today is most important for those of you who are here, so that's why you're here today. Everything is preordained. there are no accidents. Nothing just transpires by itself. That's why your attitude should always be all is well and everything's unfolding as it should. Always feel this. You have absolutely nothing to do with it. Do not allow yourself to become ruffled by the world or by situation or by anything else. What we call God loves you and knows how to take care of you. Again, your duty is to surrender and allow it to happen. Faith, satsang, self-inquiry, teachings, for what purpose? Isn't self-realization a matter of faith, grace? And anything the ego does is pointless. Just transcends. Yes. Faith is very important. Satsang is very important. Self-inquiry is very important. But to whom? It's important to you because you think you are a body. You will become lost. For you will become another human being. You will become one of the multitudes. That's why self-inquiry, satsang, all these things we do are very important. But yet you do not become realized because of them. They're very important because it quiets your mind, it makes you one-pointed. It causes you to become calm and relaxed and peaceful. And then you're able to go upward you let go of everything and become self-realized. This is the purpose of teachings. A person leaves their home, they go sit in a cave, they go to a monastery, to a Zen Buddhist monastery, a Catholic monastery. Why? To get away from the world. So they can have time in which to practice certain disciplines, spiritual disciplines. Why do they want to practice the spiritual disciplines? To quieten the mind and to become one-pointed. When that happens, grace and faith, everything takes care of itself. Therefore, do not think that sadhana is not important. I have explained to you that sadhana can never make yourself realize, but it brings you to the point where you can surrender and totally give up the body. By realizing you are not a doer, and you become free. And as much I don't see, feel changes in me, in my life, I feel this disorganized. And as much I don't see, feel changes in my life, I feel discontented, disorganized, whatever the word is. If you don't feel anything happening to you, ask yourself, what am I doing with my life? How much time am I spending practicing sadhana, practicing self-inquiry? When you get in the spiritual path, never look for results. Do not look for anything. Simply do the work, whatever it is you have to do, and leave it alone. Do not compare yourself with anyone. Do not look at time. Just do the work. It will take care of itself. If you think it's taking a long time, you've been practicing for 2 whole days and nothing has happened. Even if you're practicing for 50 years and you think nothing has happened, you're making a mistake. Just by you being here, something is happening. If you just came here and never practiced at all, something is happening within yourself. You're way ahead of the game. Remember, do not look at time. There are those people in the world, which is most of the world, that do no practice whatsoever. They just go along with the world. Think how much ahead you are than them. You cannot judge your own self. Practice, be happy, do not look for a time. Do not think about becoming self-realized. Develop humility, love, and see what happens. Is it possible to have been in a fairly high state of awareness, but due to karmic action, one has been thrust back into a lesser state? Or is it because self-inquiry feels so natural that instinctively knows this way is the right way? Every state that you go into is of the mind. The mind can play tricks on you. It can make you feel peaceful sometimes and feel high and feel that you're really up there. And then you'll feel that you've been thrown away into the world again and left alone. The truth is, you have to get rid of the mind that thinks that way. That's why self-inquiry is about the best sadhana on earth. For it goes right to the crux of the matter. It realizes that I is the culprit, the I thought is responsible for the problems, and you inquire to whom does the I thought come, following it back to the source. Therefore, whatever has happened to you in your life, whether you've gone up high and then you fell back again, you become aware this is of the mind. Don't look at your state of consciousness. Do not look at the external things, because that's the mind. Rather, get rid of the mind. You see the difference? Work on annihilating the mind. Never mind high or low states, or falling out of grace, or returning to zero. It is the mind that confuses you and confounds you and makes you think of these things. By inquiring, for whom is there a mind, you one day will realize there's only consciousness, absolute reality, and there's no mind. And then you'll be free. You say that the realization of the self is already part of our experience. When we realize self, we will laugh. What part of our present experience is self? Silence, somethingness, something else? The truth is that your present experience is the self. The part of you that thinks that you are the body is really the self. There is only the self. There is not you and the self, or you becoming the self, or anything you have to do to become the self. The self is your very nature. You really have no body. The body that appears is an optical illusion. There is no mind. There is no doer. There is no person who has to become realized. You are that. This is an important point for you to remember. What appears to be your body is the self. You have always been the self. The body is like the tree, the sky, the mountain, the wars, man's humanity to man. They're all the same. But they do not exist. Creation never began. There is no one who created anything. The appearance is that your mind created everything. Again, that's an appearance. That's a high state to be in, to be aware that your mind is responsible for creation. But then again, there is no mind. Therefore, who is responsible for creation? There is no creation. There never was a creation, there will never be a creation. This is what I mean when I say to wake up. When you wake up to the self, all this becomes very evident to you. It becomes real. That's why I say you laugh at yourself. Because all these years you've been trying to become something and do something and acquire something when you have been that all along. Therefore ask yourself, to whom do these false thoughts come? To whom does the mind come? And you will see there is no mind. Would you please repeat your suggestions about reading the transcripts before going to bed and arriving in the morning? Is there anything to be gained by being in the company of someone who seeks you out and admires you and whom you kind of dare being around? Rule number one about the transcripts. We see each other about 5-6 hours a week. The world has you more than I do. The pull of the world appears strong to some people and gets you confounded and causes all kinds of conflicts and nonsense. When you're here, you feel wonderful. When you walk out of the door and the world has a hold on you, you begin to think about worldly things. You forget about you are consciousness and you are the self and you are the only one in existence and there are no others. You begin to think of yourself as a human being and you've got to do this and you've got to do that. You've got to do all sorts of things. Therefore, the transcripts are an extension of the self. If you read the transcripts correctly, you will not have time to read 12 books a week. So everything you need to know is in the transcripts. Books may say it in different ways. So I suggest that you read one transcript a week. The proper way to do this is when you go to sleep before you can retire at night. Go over the entire transcript. Then go from paragraph to paragraph, pondering each paragraph. It's very simple, the transcript is. I make sure that they're simple and not in a way too profound that you can understand what's happening. You ponder each paragraph. The next day you do the same thing. If you're able to read part of it in the morning, a paragraph, you ponder that. As you go to work or wherever you go, you remember the paragraph that you read. You ask yourself, what does this mean to me? You assimilate it, you digest it. You carry it with you during the day. This answers the question also for many people to say, I cannot do sadhana, I cannot do self-inquiry. I cannot practice any kind of meditation. Well, if you just read a paragraph of the lesson, the transcript, and carry it with you during the day, what you read, then read the same paragraph before you go to sleep. Ponder it, digest it, assimilate it. Go to a new paragraph tomorrow. You should spend a week on each transcript. Do not be like most people, just read them through and pull them down if they're worth the next one. You can read a transcript in 5 minutes if you desire. But it will not do you any good, it will just be a bunch of words. Spend time and be quiet.
wrote it. What about parts of the transcripts that don't seem to relate to the person reading it?
To relate to what?
What if you can't relate to any certain paragraph? You just skip that?
Skip that, that's right. Okay. Go to the next one. So in essence, the benefit to be gained by being in the company of someone who seeks you out and admires you, and whom you can't bear being around. Well, if you can't bear being around someone, why should you be around them? That's simple. The person may admire you, may think great things of you, but if you can't be around them, if you can't bear being around them, by all means, do not be around them. Why should you torture yourself? You shouldn't be with people that you can't bear to be around. But then this is a dual question and answer. Where are you coming from that you can't bear to be around a certain person? Is there something inside of you that has a problem at that point? You cannot run away from the situations either. You've got to face them and not to react to them. Then you transcend them and become free. But just generally, if you cannot bear to be around someone, why should you be around them? Leave and go forth into the night. How do you not react to something or someone who upsets you? How do you not react to something or someone who upsets you? Simply by working on yourself, doing self-inquiry. By asking yourself, who is upset? Who feels this? Who's going through this? As you inquire this way, one or two things will happen. One, you will get to the stage where you will become powerful enough not to react to the person, and you will not have any feelings like that any longer. You will feel free. You will feel totally liberated from that. Number two, if you practice self-inquiry and sadhana, you will find that sooner or later that person will get out of your life. And will not be in your life again.
Guaranteed?
100%. So one of two things will happen. You'll either become so strong mentally that you will not be upset over what someone else is doing. You'll be able to look at the person and laugh. And it will not matter who is around you or who is not around you. You have risen. You have transcended. You have become... You have risen above it. You have risen higher to a higher sense of consciousness. Then again, number two, the person will get out of your life. The answer is not to look at the world not to judge by the standards of the world, but rather to know who you are, to realize the truth about yourself. To lift yourself higher. And understand your true nature. You become like this by practicing sadhana, by doing spiritual practices. Especially self-inquiry. Then automatically the changes will come. But if you do not do this, and you're like most people, when they have a problem or they're with a person they don't like, they leave and run to another person, that person will be worse than the first person they were with. They will find many problems. It's like you have a job, you can't get along with your fellow workers, and you say, I'm going to move to Denver and get away from all this. That's the human way to do it. You move to Denver and you get a new job, the novelty is new, new friends, new people. Within 6 months, Denver becomes Los Angeles. You find the same problems with different people.
When you look close enough, those people are really the same. Sure. I have to set your head in
the... They are the same people, different faces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Different languages, possibly.
Whatever. That's an escape that you think you're getting away. You can't escape your karma. But as you remain calm and peaceful, and you work on yourself diligently, you inquire, to whom does this come? Who's having this problem? And you realize it's the I thought that has this problem. You get rid of the I thought by following it to the source. The source is consciousness, God. Reality, you merge into reality, you're no longer the body, and you no longer have that problem. You're free. Boy, we had a lot of questions, didn't we? What do you think of this lesson?
I think it's very good, right?
Rather than not just talking about something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have the questions that you want to answer.
But people would bring those up anyway. And
that's right.
They're free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
think
it just wouldn't be written, it would be verbalized.
Not always, because some people are embarrassed to ask the question like that.
Oh, well, that is true. Both,
maybe.
So we had about 12, 15 questions.
13.
Robert, I have another question, too.
She's not embarrassed.
It's not written down, but I know. Anyway, the question is, what is better? In the past, you've talked about different things that we should say to ourselves before we go to sleep. Should we do the I am thought, or should we do the memorizing the transcript or memorizing the paragraph? Throughout the day, should you do the I am thought,
the self-inquiry,
or is it just a combination of all of them?
All of the things that I shared for you, with you, and what you ought to do is pick out the one that appeals to you mostly. Part of it should always be reading the transcripts, because the transcripts somehow set you off on the right path. And then the method you've got to use, whether it's self-inquiry or chanting or becoming the witness, that will come to you easier. In other words, you will know what to do by reading the paragraph in the transcript and pondering the paragraph.
But then self-inquiry is more important than doing, than saying, like, I am.
Yes. As far as I am concerned, self-inquiry is the easiest method to become realized, to awaken.
And what does the I am mean?
I am is your real self.
And you just keep saying I am?
With your breath. Yes. It's a form of meditation. When you become tired of self-inquiry after a while, if it becomes boring or you become burnt out, you can go practice the meditation. Inhale and say I, and exhale and say I am.
Instead of doing that just all the time, almost everything you're doing, you're just keeping that in
mind. It depends how you feel. It depends where you're coming from. It depends what's going on inside yourself. Use the method that is gentle to you. That does not irk you, that feels right for you. There are many ways to practice self-inquiry. Self-inquiry merely means inquiring. And you can inquire whatever happens to you. For instance, if you want to know what method to use, inquire. Ask yourself. You can ask yourself, what shall I do to get closer to awakening? Ask yourself that question. And all of a sudden, like a flash, something may come and respond and say, I am. Then you can practice the I am meditation. Sometimes nothing comes in your silence. That means you should rest in the silence and be silent for a while. But go with the flow. Do not force yourself. If you force yourself to do something, you'll hate it. And you'll say this doesn't work and you'll give it all up. But there are so many methods I share with you. You can either practice them all or practice one. The important thing is to always be doing something. Never allow the world to get to you, to grab hold of you and make you worldly. As I explained before you came late. Whenever you get up in the morning and you behold the trees and the mountains and the sky and people, become aware that these things come out of you. You are responsible for this creation. This alone makes you feel good. We realize nothing is happening without my knowledge. I am the one. Who am I? Who am I that has caused the creation to be as it is? Is there really a creation? Is there really a mind that has caused the creation to be? Am I that mind? Where did that mind come from? Keep asking, keep inquiring. And then keep still. The answers will be forthcoming. Are there any questions about the questions?
What should we do if someone asks us about can you say that whatever practice a person follows is probably the right practice for them? Because I can't say to people when they talk about their ways that self-inquiry is the best, because whatever they're following may be the best for them.
Isn't Again, what have you got to do with them?
Well, if they come and ask me, or they talk to me about their practice or something.
You can only give them your experience. Where you're at and what you're going to do and what you're doing. So you can explain to them what has helped you. That's as far as you should go with people. But do not think too much of people. Go deep within yourself. Dive within yourself. And just by being yourself, you will be an asset to others. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
If you try to talk up a storm to people and say, no, this is like this, you should do this. You should be doing it this way. This is the way you do it. I've been doing it for years. I've read many books. I know what to do.
Yeah.
It's better to keep silent. To become an example yourself. And the further you go, the less you talk. You no longer have to try to make people feel as if you know something important, you're going to help them. You simply be yourself. And anything will happen by itself.
That's how I feel, because I feel about self-inquiry that it's the practice that I like the most, but I don't want to get into a superiority kind of egotistical state, you know, about anything that I do.
Mm.
Because in the groups that I follow, each person thinks that their teacher is the most superior and that their practice is the most superior.
Mm.
And I don't want to end up in the same place saying that, you know, you're the superior and self-inquiry is the superior.
Right.
So I've never liked that about any of the spiritual.
You're right about this. This is absolutely true.
And so for me, it's just like whatever people feel drawn to is right for them.
Yes.
And I can only share how I personally feel about something, and I can't assess. I don't have the omniscience to assess what's better or worse for anybody else except for myself.
True. But don't go into long spiels with people about spiritual practice. If you want to talk about self-inquiry, explain it, be succinct, two or three sentences, and say, go do it.
Well, sometimes I like to serve people by advising them about some of the things that you say, but I know that I haven't realized them in my own experience, so I sort of move sometimes just to be silent about it rather than speak it, because like you say that self-inquiry is superior to yoga in some ways, and many people practice yoga.
Mm.
In a way, I can't say that it's superior because I don't know. See what I mean?
I'm sharing this with you.
Right, that's from your experience.
Yes. But do not go around and tell people what to practice or what not to practice.
Right.
If someone comes to you and asks you, then you can be succinct and give them a couple of answers.
Right.
That you've experienced yourself.
But only from what I've experienced and not necessarily. Because in the data, I noticed that people sort of know too much. You're far beyond their own experience, and they like to talk about levels beyond what they've experienced because they've read and listened. And does that make sense for them?
Yes, of course.
And in my experience, I don't know that as much, you know, and I try to share just what I know, right or wrong.
I don't share too much. Unless you say you've done it awfully wrong. It's like the people used to come here from Santa Cruz. And they used to phone me about 3 times a day. And then one day they told me they were all enlightened. They are, in reality. But now I hear they're enlightened with another teacher. And I'll go on like this, being enlightened with different teachers. So that's good. There's nothing wrong with this at all. Be a lamp unto thyself, as Buddha said. Leave everybody alone. The more you run around, the more confused you get. You and I both know people who have been running around for 20, 30, 40 years. And they're very confused. They've had so many teachings, they don't know what's right and what's wrong. So they get to the point where they believe, if I only find the right teacher, I'll push the button in my brain and I'll be free.
Well, that's what's true for them. And
that,
so...
That's very difficult.
There's nothing that can be said.
There's nothing that can be said.
You know, because maybe that's their way, and maybe for them that's their path, you know, of realization. And I can't compare myself to...
This
know,
is true.
You understand what I'm saying?
Of course, this
otherwise
is very true.
We get into a whole, you know, posture of I know better than you, and,
yes.
You know... Let them do what they want to do.
That's what I'm saying. Leave them alone.
Because who knows? Because, you know, if they meet the right person, that might be their path. And for me, it might be different.
Anything is possible.
Anything is possible. That's what I was saying.
Leave everybody alone.
Live and let live and just do your own thing.
And let's party.
Right.
Party.
Sometimes you talk about confusion, being confused, and you have said that can be good because it's a not knowing, claiming I don't know anymore. Is confusion good, or is confusion more or less, you know, is the being lost, is that good, or is being lost mean?
In the beginning stages, confusion is good. When you're first learning, when you're first getting on the spiritual path, you study this and you read that, and you go through many teachers and you're trying to find out what's what, and you become totally confused. So to an extent, that's good at that point of your life. But then you have to realize, what do I do now? And something within you should tell you, you've got to become sort of steady. You've got to sort of find the one path and practice that path. Get involved in that particular path. Give it your all in all. And see what happens. But to go through the years, year after year after year, and still be confused because you're into so many teachings, it's sort of a waste of time.
Well, if you go to one teacher and he always contradicts himself, and because of that you're confused, is that confusion good for your growth, or... And that just keep you in ignorance?
It depends on the faith you have in the teacher. If you know the teacher is a self-realized being and is not just an ordinary teacher, then everything that comes out of that teacher's mouth is important and is for your benefit. And even if it seems contradictory, it's for your growth and for your well-being. But if the teacher is just a yogi or a ordinary philosopher, then you have to look for the Satguru or the teacher that you need and the teacher that you can surrender to, that you can give up all of your material thoughts and all of your hurts and all of your desires and merge with the teacher. Then whatever the teacher says is for your benefit, and there's no confusion. And if you feel confusion, you should realize that it's the ego that feels this. And inquire who is confused.
The purpose of self-inquiry is to quiet the mind.
Yes.
Yet, if the mind is active, can the mind be active? Yet, if you are not attached to that activity, can it be quiet at the same time as being active because of the non-attachment?
No, if you're not attached, it means your mind is quiet. It is virtually impossible to be attached to something or someone and have a quiet mind. You can't do both.
I'm talking about activity, like if you are working throughout the day, right? But of course the purpose of self-inquiry is to quiet the mind. So could the mind be active in what you're doing, but if you're not attached to it, it's like, well, I'm doing this, but, you know, I'm not identifying with it. Is that a state of being quiet?
As the mind becomes quiet, you will do your work and be very active.
That's what I'm asking.
But it has nothing to do with the mind. The mind has been transcended.
Well, what is it then?
It is the self. There is only the self. The self is doing your work. The self is functioning as the world, as the universe. The appearance is there's a world, there's work, but there's only the self. So when you're doing the work, it is not the mind any longer with an advanced person that does the work, but it is the self that is functioning. And you have no thought.
But it takes the form of occasional thoughts?
Takes one?
It takes the form of what might be considered thoughts?
You do things spontaneously. You do your work well. Everything is done.
Even when you're learning,
even when
you're
learning,
is going. I mean, it's not spontaneous. You're learning how to hook up the system.
Even when you're learning,
yeah.
The doer has been destroyed.
Yeah.
And everything is done by itself.
So quieting the mind has nothing to do with activity or lack of it.
No. The mind will be quiet and you'll still be able to do your work. But you'll be in bliss, you'll be in peace.
What about the...
I'm talking about the process, not the, you know, not the end. I'm saying the process. And be active and still be non-attached.
Yes.
So the mind seems to be working, but if you don't identify with it, then it's almost like while you're active, you could still be doing self-inquiry, not...